Anniversary of that song, we play that, and it wasn't Mark's fault, it was my fault. I didn't let him know we were going to play it, but he got it up there now, so that's all that counts. We are now going to start our conversation about what's going on in Baltimore. There are more murders in Baltimore this year than there are days. There are 17 altogether killings, 16 on the streets of Baltimore by civilian, one by police killing a man in his car. So 17 people have died violently in Baltimore City this year. So what do we do about that? We look where these murders took place, and you can see where they take place around the city. We talk about Baltimore being unsafe, but what's unsafe in certain cities, certain neighborhoods in our communities. These murders took place of everybody was 48 or under. Most people who were killed were in their 30s and 20s, 117, one a little baby. The oldest person being 51 years old, but they took place around Edmondson Avenue, Patterson Park and North Avenue, the whole Patterson Park area around Liberty Heights and Ashburton, Pall Mall Road, and on the northwest side, Maryland and 22nd, on the west side and Frederick Avenue, McLean Boulevard, Madison Street on the east side, Reisterstown Road, Edgewood. That's where the murders took place, in our working class communities. So what do we do to address that? Next week, Commissioner Batts is committed to coming on. We'll talk about him. We'll talk with him about that. But one of the things we'll talk with him about is what comes out of this conversation today on the Mark Steiner Show. We want you to join us with your ideas at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet me at Mark Steiner. We're here with Michael Johnson, Executive Director of the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change once again. Donya Johnson is with us, back with us, student leader with the Intersection Youth Project. Good to have you back on the air with us, Donya. Ulysses Cofield is with us. He's the 2014 Open Society Institute Baltimore Community Fellow, founder of CORE, an after-school program in East Baltimore, a young man who has turned his own life around from days in the street to what he's doing now. Good to have you on the show, and welcome. Good to meet you.
Thank you.
And once again, joining us is Doug Ward, Director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University, a 30-year veteran of the state police. Do I have that right?
27, Mark.
27, yes. Okay. Almost 30. Close. Of the Maryland State Police. We retired as a major, correct?
That's correct. Yes,
right.
Thanks.
So join us here, 410-319-8888. So we see these murders happening in our communities, and people are always kind of wringing their hands about what do we do? What are we not doing? Doug, let me start with you, if I might. Just because when we met in the green room, you came up with this list of things that you were about to teach in one of your courses at Hopkins, and your students are police for the most part, right?
Yes, they are. You have police, federal, state, and local, and other public safety officials. I was preparing for class, and I did a literature search of what's been done on gangs. It's one of the topics we're going to talk about on Friday, is poverty and gangs. And It occurred to me that in many of the conversations we have, here's what typically happens around the country. Something comes to a tipping point. There's murders. There's some robbery string. There's all kinds of things going on. And then, oh, my goodness, we have gangs. What are we going to do about it? And the police step forward. They say, we're going to try program X, and it's going to solve this, and we're going to get to the root of it. And although the police are a really, really key component, the unfortunate thing the literature shows clearly is that the problem with gangs starts in poverty. The problem with gangs starts when they're in middle school. So I think first thing to do is really understand more about gangs, why they occur. It's a social status issue. It's a hopelessness issue. And it starts with our youth. And even now, I hear it's elementary school is the place to start. Mm-hmm. So by the time the police get involved after the murder, after the robbery, after the incident, that's helpful, but it's not preventing the stream of youth coming into the system. And until we all, from all disciplines, address that, and the bad news, I'm afraid, is it can't happen overnight.
Ulysses Cofield, let me turn to you next, because you, if I have this correct, and you can correct me, you started out your young existence on the corner yourself.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And, I did, and just I was speaking to
Doug Ward.
Mr. Ward back in the green room, and I was telling him, you know, to me, the solution, you know, is simple. I look at reasons why I stepped out or came off the porch or wanted to be independent, and it's for all the same reasons that we get dressed and come to work in the morning. You know, it's the same thing, and you know, being a young child and not really having no direction, or if your parent is home or getting on drugs or incarcerated or, you know, whatever, you want to be able to be independent from that. So I feel like, you know, even when I was out, if you can hire or enlist in the help of a 10-year-old child to help you move a product and support them financially, of course, the option is going to be to go with them. It doesn't matter if you can go to school and see a coach you for 4 hours or 5 hours while you're at school, because at the end of the day, you're going home hungry, or at the end of the day, you know, you can't change your clothes. And I really think that, you know, creating ways for our children to be financially free to a certain extent would really, you know, just do away with a lot of those situations, because like Mr. Ward said, it's grooming at a young age. If I'm 5 or if I'm 10 or 9 and I know every time I walk down Ashland Avenue or Kenwood or Chase Street, somebody gonna give me a dollar or $5, and now I can feed myself tonight and don't have to worry about if my mom is out or my dad is, you know, wherever when I come home. I know I can stop at a local corner store and get what I need.
One of the stories, well, the picture you paint right here, and we are going to get the phones here, so Quentin and the others, we're going to come to 410-319-8888. I think this is a quick side digression for a moment. I think it's important because what you described is the life of a corner boy in Baltimore, not a kid making thousands of dollars.
Right, exactly.
That we have this image of people making all this money.
Exactly.
It's survival money.
It's survival money.
Yeah, right, right. And Donya, I mean, when you were on the show last, you made some very powerful statements about your own life and what you've seen.
I feel like in a situation where a city is without, you know, employment, or, you know, where the youth aren't financially free in Baltimore, our youth unemployment rate is 44%, and that only counts youth that are looking for a job. So in a situation where, you know, you have a city filled with unemployment, not only youth but adults, then, you know, an unemployed city is an unhappy city.
Exactly.
You know, a group of people who have to go into survival mode, you know, that's a problem, because that says that there's a reason for, you know, that going into survival, right? So I definitely think that, you know, being a youth in Baltimore is tough, and, you know, growing up in poverty is tough. And that definitely, like, causes problems for that youth, for that individual.
So one of the things, and I want to throw out some solutions for everybody to wrestle with in this panel, for our listeners to wrestle with. I was going to start at the top in terms of the overview of what the city might do, but let me start from where what you just said. This is also part of what the city can do, because you said youth. If we can redesign a budget in the city, if that was possible, it's around 2% of the budget of Baltimore City goes to rec and parks. And we always talk about rec and parks being important to communities and young people. But what would it mean, and what it would take, and what effect would it have? I mean, you can open a building. Opening a building is got to do more than open a building. It has to do with the people employed in that building. It has to do with young people coming out of universities like this who want to make a difference and work with young people. It has to do, I mean, it's very different. We just can't open a building. So what does it mean to redesign where we should be investing some money? Let's start with the Rec and Parks. You started talking about youth. Both of you started talking about youth.
I would definitely, you know, say that, you know, along with, you know, opening a building, I really don't think that it's – I think that the children that we come across are creative enough to create venues to make their own income. It's just about helping them get in a position to do it, and not overlooking some of our children. I mean, I work with some of the most talented and creative children I feel in you know, the world. These children are just amazing, so I know they can find ways to create their own stream of income.
You know, the first thing we would have to do, obviously, we can open up buildings, but if you have no real programs, it doesn't really matter. I mean, this is about poverty. All crime, everything ends up at the end of the day, it's about poverty. It's about unemployment. It's also about really what a young person should be making. Who says a young person should be making anything? If the parents have an opportunity for employment, if the parents or an adult have an opportunity for employment, then young people necessarily, you know, they are child labor laws out here. So we have to be a little bit careful when we always just suggest that. When we say about the 2% of being parks and recreation, well, we have to redo the city. We have to make a conscious effort of what's important about the city. Parks and recreation was important when you had about 1 million people, more than 700,000 people, and they were outsourcing recreation. Today, we need jobs. There are no jobs. There are people who are making millions of dollars, and in all due respect to the police department, not you, but in particular, Doug, but the police department who are out there. How many police are we hiring from Baltimore City? We're sending kids through high school, through the city of Baltimore, in hundreds. And you and I had this conversation weeks ago about young people not going to college. Where are we? Been making them, providing them to say that you can help protect the city? Every young person is not out here trying to make money. Some young people out here are just trying to find a way. And the problem is that what we have in the city is we have a huge poverty. Celebrating the 50th anniversary of Johnson's War on Poverty has shown that there have been some ups and many, many, many lows. And one of the biggest lows that we have right now is we have no training programs and jobs that could eliminate the possibility. If there is a child, teenager, young person, who has the ability to work versus the ability to sell drugs, the ability to work will override the ability mm-hmm. to sell drugs. Mm-hmm. But we haven't made that decision yet because people are making money also off of crime, not just drug dealers. Yeah. People have gotten great programs in the city. The programs that these two young people have right now need to be duplicated in the city, not just stuck in East Baltimore. In all due respect to you, my brother, it's just that if we do not say that we have a poverty problem, we have an unemployment problem, we have a housing and a health problem in the city, then we can throw 2, 3, 4% in the Department of Recreation, and it's not going to matter.
Well, I think that's fundamentally true. I think you hit it on the head with that. But there are a number of things that we can do along a parallel track while we're working on poverty, because that's a tough one. But I think the city understands that. I think there are people working on trying to do that, but it's going to take a long time. But let's look at the potential gang members. You know, the data show they have low self-esteem, that they have poor school performance and commitment to the school, and they have a large anti-authority attitude, right? So and what that means is if the only contact youth have with authority figures, let's take police, is negative. And let's face it, that's mostly what they have is a negative, right? They're doing something wrong and the police approach them. Then they tend to develop this all authority is bad attitude, and they're going to do things to go against it just to do that. Those can be addressed by, you talked about parks and rec and programs, right? Some these programs can help youth have success in with the low self-esteem, with the anti-authority figures. I mean, there used to be programs around the country where police went into schools. I mean, when I was a young trooper, I went into elementary schools and middle schools and gave talks on a regular basis.
Officer friendly.
exactly. Well, you know, but those things are gone, unfortunately. Yeah. I hate to tell, they're pretty much gone. We had a PAL program here in Baltimore.
That's gone.
You know, it wasn't perfect, but it was the right approach. Now, we're all strapped for cash. Governments are strapped for cash, and it's tough to do programs without money. But we have to find ways to do these things. And until you start, you know, addressing the poverty, and you got to have, you know, grocery stores, you got to have places for people to work in neighborhoods, you got to have, you know, the minimum wage is a start. Can we do something as a nation about those kind? You know, you got to start somewhere.
And, I mean, the problem that we have is that's true, absolute, but we also have millions, almost billions of dollars being funneled through Baltimore City for programs. And no one is really checking balances about who is actually doing what. You're getting 501c3 groups that are coming through the city of Baltimore who say they are doing things, but you don't see the outcome of the so-called things that they're doing.
Well, you know, some of the things, let me go to the phones here, that we can kind of talk about. There are things from the macro level that can be done. I mean, I remember when David Kennedy was on the show numerous times in the past when he wanted to bring Operation Ceasefire to Baltimore, mm-hmm. and it didn't work because then Mayor O'Malley didn't want it. And his program was – it works in other cities, North Carolina, around, mm-hmm. around the country, where they have people who are known to be the ones who commit the most violent crimes, other crimes in surrounding communities, are brought before the community, parents, clergy, police, everyone's there to say, we know who you are. Mm-hmm. We can help you or we can get rid of you. I mean, and the other kind of programs they have, you know, there are Know Your Neighbors, like in Greensboro, North Carolina. Some people don't like this program, but it's these citizens start working to watch their own community and work with the police and work with the young people. And that's cut crime in this in as I was reading this morning, it has cut crime by 43% in neighborhoods in Greensboro, North Carolina, by just changing that attitude. The other one is there's an interesting studies that have come out about called greener cities. There's something called the hedonism, the hedonic set point. So people have studied at the University of Illinois and in Amsterdam, around cities all over the country and all over Europe, that we have a city full of barren plots, empty plots, houses gouged out. Getting rid of those, turning those plots into gardens and community gardens and into parks, changes the attitude of people. Mm-hmm. You have a place to meet. You have a place to walk. You have a place to go to. I mean, those things are something you can do from a macro level that just deal with the kind of immediate issues while you're also working on the systemic issues of unemployment. It's got to go all ways.
But the problem is what we're suggesting is that they are intact communities and intact neighborhoods. It used to be intact communities and intact neighborhoods. But if you've got strips upon strips of vacant housing and neighborhoods, and where, as we tell them, houses that, where did those people go? Where did those people go?
So any other thoughts in here before we go to the phones? Because there are a lot of people calling in.
I feel like youth in, you know, this poverty-stricken community as a whole aren't often enough put into leadership positions, you know. So you have the police who are in authority, but that's it, right? It's just I feel like sometimes an abuse of authority, you know. Like I've seen so many people shaken down that it's ridiculous, right? So you get this, and anybody who I feel attacks me in some way becomes like an enemy to me. So you have like this general department of people who, you know, all of a sudden I feel are attacking me, and that's what sticks in my mind. Not that they're out to protect me or to help me or to save me, just that, you know, they're constantly attacking me and the people in my community.
That's the contradiction you were talking about earlier, Doug.
Exactly, and that is counterproductive in the whole system. I mean, that the attitudes – same. Let's take schools, for example. It's the same thing with graffiti and destruction to property to schools. If students feel affiliated with the school – in other words, it's my school and I'm proud to be part of this school, I am much less likely to damage the school or do any of this. And it's the same thing with the neighborhood or you know, in the association with authority figures, police being one of the main authority figures that you see mostly. So how police treat people matters in the long term. And that's something I think we need to look at.
And just real quick, that's something that we created down Fort Worthington, you know, and trying to get people to just, you know, by human nature, we just selfish. So, you know, donating an hour or two to for our children to see a police officer or to see somebody positive at a young age and to be proud of the facility that they're a part of, like he says, creates a big change.
We are going to take a brief break and come right back. We're going to go out with a little Junior Wells Viet Cong Blues. And we are going to come back and go to Quentin and Dante in that order, get your calls on the air, and come back to this conversation with our guest, 410-319-8888. When you call us today, bring us some solutions, your thoughts on what we could do to change things. We'll be right back.
You wake up early in the morning, baby, and you don't have nothing to eat. You can't buy yourself no clothes, baby. Lord knows who can you. I said, baby, everything gonna be all right. I say, hey, everything gonna be all right. You know I love you, baby.
and I just can't help myself. Oh, baby, wanna prove my love for you. Somebody better come here, I spit. I said, I gotta prove my love for you. Without you, pretty baby, I don't.
Welcome back. Junior Wells telling us everything is going to be all right. I hope he's right. We're talking about what's going on in our community in terms of the violence and what we can really do to stop the violence in our community and really come up with some solutions here, ideas for solutions to really begin a conversation. We're here with Michael Johnson, Executive Director of the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change, Donya Johnson, Student Leader with the Intersection Youth Project, Doug Ward, who is Director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University, former state trooper, Ulysses Cofield, who is it Cofield or Caulfield? How do you say it?
Cofield.
Cofield, make sure I say it right. Ulysses Cofield, who is a 2014 Open Society Baltimore Community Fellow and founder of CORE, an after-school program in East Baltimore, 410-319-8888. Quentin, you're on the air.
How are you? Thank you, Mark. My main objective here is to kill it at the root, which is the drug manufacturing. And if you kill it at the root, then you stop a percentage of any murders or anything you have going on because they have nothing to fight over. If you start with your justice system, tighten up your laws, because people come here from other cities to commit crime because they know they don't get time. They know they won't get a lot of time. They know they do a little bit and they're gone. They move on. So if you do it in a level where you address the entire thing where at the cancerous part of it, kill the cancer, which is the manufacturing. I have a place that's right next door to my home. They manufacture drugs on a regular basis, cook coke, and it comes through the wall.
Did anybody in your neighborhood call in and say, hey, officers, there's a drug manufacturing place next door to us?
Any excuses? They have so many, and it's been for over a year and a half, Mark. Over a year and a half I've been dealing with the DEA part of the police department. They say if it's not people walking in and out and have drugs in their hand and giving it to people in the street, this guy manufactures it on a regular level, starts cooking at 5 in the morning. He gets 8 to 9 batches of it and he takes it somewhere.
What I would suggest is next week when Commissioner Batts is on the show, then you call in and talk to Batts about it. And maybe if you want to contact us, we can get your contact information and talk to them. And so nobody knows who you are. They don't know what. And so, I mean, if that's real, and I'm not saying it's not. Mm-hmm. But that stuff goes on. And one of the things people are trying to do right now in Annapolis, which could have a dent, when you talk about going to the source, listen, people are trying to go to the source of stopping drug traffic for 40 years, for 50 years. It's not going to happen. But when you start talking about legalization of marijuana, decriminalization of other drugs, that could have a dent, Doug, in...
That's absolutely correct. So you know, I know that's a controversial topic, but the fact is we've lost the war on drugs in this nation. I mean, let's just face facts, okay? That's not working for us. So, we have to look at alternatives, and decriminalization of certain drugs is part of it to relieve pressure from the system. Mm-hmm. Drug treatment is a big part of it, and demand for drugs. So, you know, if you look at the amount of tonnage of drugs seized in this country alone – and look in the city. There aren't enough people living in the city to use it all. So who's buying it? You know, this is an economics issue, really, when you get right down to it. This is about an underground economy that's huge. And the police and federal agents only know a piece of it, the tip of the iceberg, right? And so this is an economic mm-hmm. problem. And there are a lot of people around buying these drugs from outside of the city. This is just the shopping center.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask a quick question. I don't want to take a long time on this, because I want to go to our next caller, Dante. But Ulysses, let's say you're Quentin's neighbor. I'm very serious here. You're Quentin's neighbor. And whether it's heroin or cocaine, whatever's being prepared in the house next to you, down your block, what do you do? What is a neighbor's response if they know that two houses away from them, people are cooking dope?
Like you said, it's frustrating. It's a frustrating thing, you know. And once you have a block or, you know, something set up for operation, it's hard to get those guys out of your neighborhood. Not to say that it's impossible or whatever, but the best thing to do, you know, in that type of situation is get to know the person. I mean, I know it sounds, you know, crazy. I'm not telling you to go knock on his door or whatever, but, you know, you see him out and about, you know, get to know him and you know, figure out really what's going on with that person. Assumptions and different things is the worst thing that anybody could do, especially if you that close or involved, you know, or see it on a daily basis. You know, get to know them on a different level other than, hey, I know you're a local whatever or whatever, but I want to get to know you on a different level and see where it goes.
Would you call the police if that happened in your block, Danya?
I definitely think I would, but I feel like we too often villainize people and dehumanize them. You know, you have this guy next door to you, and you're, like, ready to just throw all these accusations at him. I bet you have a million things floating in your mind about who he is and what his life is like. I feel like, I was reading an article about Commissioner Betts, you know, with the whole comment that he made. And I'm like, you can't take away the value of somebody's life, even if they were drug dealers or even if they were murderers or robbers. Does that mean that their lives aren't just as valuable as somebody else's?
Mm-hmm. Can we go back to the phones? Oh, go ahead, Doug.
I just think that one of the other things that may be involved in this is some fear. I mean, if you're living next door and you don't know who they are and you know they're drug dealers and you call the police, I mean, aren't you thinking, you know, even if they go to jail, they're still running operations from inside the jail. Am I going to be safe? You know, I mean, you can't tell me that there's not a lot of people out there who don't want to go testify, who don't want to step up because they don't want to be targeted by the bad guys, right? So that's an issue that can – and we've seen that in other cities with other problems. We've seen it, you know, over the years. There's plenty of history on this. When people are intimidated, they're not going to report much, and I think there's some of that going on.
And when we have an opportunity, especially, but in Baltimore City where you have police officers who are protecting drug dealers and police officers who are selling drugs, like from Reisterstown Road at the Northwestern District. I mean, I think that there's an overhaul. I think you made a point earlier, Doug, and Mark did as well, is that, you know, when we say an overhaul, we need to overhaul a lot of things. We need to overhaul attitudes, police department, and the citizenry. Because if someone is next to me, and I know there are children in the neighborhoods, and I perceive them to doing what they're doing, my immediate intent is going to be, because it could be not drugs, it could be explosives, it could be a lot of other things. My immediate response is, I'm calling.
Well, we remember what happened to the Dawson family.
Right, right.
Who were murdered because they stood up to say, we don't want this happening in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So that fear is real.
Absolutely.
And we don't have the mechanism to protect people. Let me go get a couple quick calls in here. 410-319-8888. Dante, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Mark. This is a great dialogue, but what I want to contribute to is when we talk about the violence in Baltimore City, we have to look at it from multiple lenses, and I think a lot of times we only look at it through one lens, whether that's public safety by itself, criminal justice, public health, social work. But I think we need to combine the lenses to be able to look at what's going on with the violence. And I'm listening to some of the conversation in reference to the question you posed about recreation and parks and young people and things of that nature and facilities just being a building and not really having programming. And what could we do? And some of the things that I look at, because if we listen to even what some of the panelists, their statements about their childhood or them growing up, all of it is traumatic. It's a traumatic. Poverty is traumatic. Economics in Baltimore, all these things are traumatic experiences. And what I see, even with our programming, staff and recreation and parks, to a degree, they're not equipped to deal with the trauma that a person is experiencing. We can talk about finances and young people being employed at a later stage, but if we don't address the trauma that they're going through, whether that trauma is being hungry, the mother being neglectful, the father being aggressive, if our facilities and programs don't incorporate things from these multiple lenses, we're going to always see violence because it's going to be a deficit behavior that people always display. And so when we talk about solutions, I think one of the solutions is having more of a broader perspective on how to provide services. traditional after-school programming, academics and karate and sports, that's not really helping anyone who has socio-emotional concerns, and that's the behavior that we see. And so I think collectively, if we really want to have some type of prevention, intervention, program and services, we got to really look at a collaborative bigger picture that we can address the social-emotional ills of individuals, and then we'll be able to see a decrease in crime, because in addressing that, you can teach those new skills that some of these panelists are actually talking about.
Now, Dante, what we'll do is next week I'm going to have you in the studio rather than on the phone. This is, I know the voice. This is Dante Wilson. Dante Wilson runs Collington Square. He has a rec center. He's an MSW graduate from Morgan State University. He is, to me, is one of the most effective therapists of young people in the city that we have, who understands these things in great depth. And I think that's part of it. I think we don't get this when, and I just, let me harken back to an old man thing for a minute, that 40 years ago when I was doing this work, and I was a street club worker, part of the Departments of Rec, and then after that I worked for pretrial intervention, we actually took classes at the Maryland School of Social Work. We took classes at the Washington Psychiatric Institute to learn how to deal therapeutically and run counseling programs with young people to deal with what Dante's talking about. Mm-hmm. We don't train our rec workers that way anymore. We were trained 40 years ago how to address the issues families and kids face. We don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. That is one way that we invested money in a different way in the city to systemically deal with the crisis, because it is a crisis and we're not doing that. I think that what Dante's raising here is a very important issue.
And Dante runs, he's a brilliant gentleman. I'm fortunate enough to know him. And I think that one of the things that we're clear is we've got to find out how we got there. Once we can figure out how we get there, then we can figure out how we can fix it.
And just for Dante, you know, we're right down the street from each other. This is what I mean by, you know, let's collaborate, bring programs together. There's no reason why Fort Worthington children aren't having recreational Collington Square children, because at the end of the day, that cuts down on violence too.
See, somebody, if you were with Dante Wilson and he was performing the therapy and group sessions with kids, and the mind dumps he has every day with these children, and you were working in sports attached to that, that is an overall kind of way you can do it. But it's, they have to go together. You just can't do football. You've got to have the other part that heals our wounds.
And that's what we, you and I were talking earlier, is that we have to collaborate more.
Right.
Looking at it from a leadership perspective, one of the things we try and teach is leadership. And I think there are probably hundreds of programs, public and private, not-for-profits, government agencies, state, federal, local, all working on potentially really important and beneficial programs and approaches. But what I don't see is a overall coordination of the effort and knowledge of what one another are doing, and some plan put together by a combination of those leaders from those groups who can come together. I don't know whether you want to call it a coordinating council or something, but something from our leadership that says, this is what we're trying to build, this is what we're trying to get to, these are the most promising programs. And you have to allow creativity. You can't just come in with it and say, this is the way it's going to be. You have to allow these experiments and creativity, but to gain the knowledge of what's working, what's promising practice, and coordinate it all together so everybody knows what's going on. We're all working towards the same thing. I don't see that. I mean, I know there are a lot of really good people working on a lot of really good things.
Correct.
But every time I talk to different people, it's the same story. Well, I didn't know you were doing that. Wow, that's really cool.
That's it.
Let me go back to another caller, and he'll come right back to the two of you. And I have a thought about how we might be able to start this. Maybe we'll do that as soon as we take a break on the air, rather than doing it on the air. 410-319-8888. I'm going to go now to Bobby. Marvin Holmes is calling in. Bobby's one of our former producers who's now gone back to working with young people in our community. Bobby, welcome.
All right. How you doing? How you doing, everyone?
Very well. Welcome.
Hey, Bobby.
In one of my group sessions of two of my youth, I asked them to share some of the issues that impact them. And both of these young men come from the same economic background, and they laid out their issues, and it was very different. One young man said, well, people cling to the streets. They go to the streets because they want to make money. And they want to make money to buy the latest clothes, the latest shoes. Why? Because they want to be affirmed. They're looking for someone to affirm their self-worth and who they are in their peer group. And another young man said, well, that's the issue. People are looking to be accepted, and they feel a need to cling to materialism to find value within themselves. And then two young men from the same background, but two different perspectives on poverty. They're both poverty and poverty. They have two different perspectives on what impacts them with the same exact issue. And I think we often blank the issue, saying that, well, it's unemployment and, well, it's poverty. And I think we really need to be deeper with our approach on how we address the youth and the culture that they are experiencing and the culture here in America that demands them, that says, in order for you to have self-worth, in order for you to have stature in the society, you must first cling to our clothes, you must first cling to whatever we may sit in front of you for you to have value. I think we really need to look at our cultural issues, because if we simplify things too much by saying, well, it's drugs, well, it's unemployment, no, it's much deeper than that.
Bobby, it's always good to hear from you. And as I said to you when we saw each other the other week at the Annapolis Summit, the next time we see each other here, you're going to be a guest on the show.
Right,
to help us wrestle with this. Thank you for so much. Donya, what did you think about what Bobby was saying?
I definitely think that, you know, we have to address some of the, like, emotional and mental stuff that happens with trauma. This summer we did a gun violence campaign where we talked to 450 people in the community in Baltimore. And during the middle...
You're your group, The Intersection.
Yeah, with The Intersection.
Right.
So in the middle of the campaign, one of my peers had a cousin who was shot in the back of her truck. And that was extremely traumatic for him. And in that moment, without the support of, you know, his friends and without the support of Mr. Cohen, who is our executive director, and without, you know, that group support, you know, he could have, anything could have happened, right? So I definitely think having a group of supporters and a group of people who help you to be nourished and to develop is essential in growing and in developing, especially when you live in poverty. And especially when you have homes that don't always have all the components that are needed to help a kid be successful.
Should we go back to the phones? Unless you all, somebody wants to jump.
I just want to touch on what Mr. Ward was saying about the, you know, the collaborations. I just really want to just take this chance. And anybody that's listening, that's heading up an organization or doing, leave the egos at the door. I really think that's where we, a lot of our organizations get hung up at. You know, like I say, it's, we get into this whole beat your chest match or look what I did. And at the end of the day, you know, if you're really serious about what you're doing and really looking for social change, it's no awards. It's no awards in it. It's no award.
I want to go back to the phone here, but what you're saying, Ulysses, and what Doug was saying, what Michael was saying earlier, what Dante Calden saying, maybe what has to happen, things don't always happen in this gargantuan way. Maybe a group of 10 or 15 people have to sit around a table and start talking about what this means, not on the air, but in another place to say, okay, this is where it begins. How do you make it? How do you make it blossom? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think that's how things begin. And because it's not going to happen, you're not going to get your city council people voting this tomorrow morning because they want to pass laws about people not smoking near schoolyards as opposed to dealing with the murders in the street. I mean, so I said, you know, so we have to. So arrest me when I was 15 for smoking a cigarette. That's what we need to do.
Near the swings.
You know?
The swings that aren't there anymore.
Right. Okay. So I think this, it is important. Yeah. Now, let me look at a quick call here on the phone. There's so many people calling in. We have like 10 minutes left in this part of the conversation. We'll come back to this. I think we need to do this clearly. It's something our listeners want to do and come back on a more regular basis weekly to kind of really wrestle with this with everybody and get all these ideas on the table. Let's go to 410-319-8888. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Keith.
One of the things that I do not hear nobody talking about is our politicians. I think the youth need to understand that organizing and coalition building is extremely important. I think you also need to follow some of the history of the civil rights movement. Follow and understand your brothers and sisters in terms of how they organized during the civil rights movement. Go back and study your history and bring these tactics to the forefront. Learn how to hold your politicians responsible. Don't let them sugarcoat you. You all express your demands, because what you're dealing with is oppression. You're dealing with issues that involve social justice. And I have long thought that the youth and citizens of Baltimore City are culturally and have been culturally deprived for centuries. Generations and generations of cultural deprivation. You look at Baltimore County and all the other surrounding counties, they have recreation. They have a lot of things that you all should have as well to enhance the quality of your lives. Follow and go back and study the history of the Black Panthers. Understand how they organized in their communities in California. Go back and follow Martin Luther King. Understand a lot of the problem with our youth today is they don't know their history.
All right. Okay. I appreciate you holding on, Keith, for that. Go ahead, Donya.
I definitely, you know, as a student leader and organizer and activist in Baltimore, understand what it means to advocate for change and to talk to my city council and to have mayor forums and to, you know, lobby and to do all that stuff, right? But I also understand that the power is in organizing among the people first, right? You can't just say, okay, I'm going to City Hall today and I'm going to change everything, because that's not going to happen, right? It's just not. You have to understand that in organizing your peers and in organizing the people around you, you are developing power. Exactly. And that's what we learn at the intersection, along with our history and along with, you know, learning that the kids in Birmingham, Alabama left school to, you know, make this humongous movement that youth have been involved throughout history in making change. Right. You know, we also understand that we have to look at, you know, the people who have done great things in the future in order to, you know, grow ourselves. Right, right. I mean, yeah, in the past, in order to develop ourselves, while also just taking the traits that we already have as youth, and not trying to change everything about ourselves, but using the things that we already have in order to make effective change.
Yes, and I think one of the keys here, too, I mean, if you think about politics and politicians, they respond best to votes, people who vote. So one of the things is the voter registration. Get people out to vote. Get organized around issues. And youth, I think going back to what we learned from the 60s is important. I mean, being active and concerned builds community. So youth can be part of that. And that can also inoculate other youth against this gang culture. A positive, we can change things attitude. And I worry that we've lost some of the lessons of the 60s. So I agree with the caller.
I mean, I think the thing that what you were just saying, something interesting that we, as we talked about the other day on the program about the war on poverty, one of the things that came out in that program was the Black Panther Party was founded out of the war on poverty. Mm-hmm. They were poverty workers, anti-poverty workers that formed the Black Panthers. And that's where it came from. And when you register people, when you organize people to vote, register people to vote, it becomes only as good as the organization that keeps the records, so that you go out to the back to the people you've registered to get them involved and get them to vote, and you build something. It does take work to build something like that, and that's otherwise, you know, all the council people in the world is just going to go, that's nice. But
there's a program a program that they're doing up in Northwestern right now where we are all young people that turn 18 years old by
Northwestern
November,
High School.
In Northwestern High School, my alumni.
School they want to close.
The school they ain't going to close.
Hello.
But at the end of the day, we have gotten the young people that are turning 18 by November, and we're getting them certified to register people to vote. And so now you're going to have this massive 50 young people who are being certified to go out and do exactly what you said. Instead of just filling out the forms, and we'll move on because I know you have callers, and just dropping it in the mail and making sure they get the form, is to keep the information. And as they keep the information, they can come back to them.
Let's get a quick call here. We have like 3 minutes left. I think about 3 minutes. Am I right, Mark? Let's go to Robert on line five.
Hello.
Hey, Rod, we only have a few minutes left. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Great. And I think a lot of you people have said a number of things that I wanted to say. I do think it's important to understand there's a fundamental problem with the social order itself, and so that a social movement will be necessary. But I think the young lady, I didn't get your name. Well, I got your name, but I forgot.
Donya.
My apologies. She made a very important statement, and that is about organizing at the grassroots. Just remind you, somebody, you know, when the Montgomery bus boycott happened, the crime rate dropped 50%. When the movement came in time, crime rate dropped. You create a sense of community when you create a movement, and you get people actively involved. I think that's one of the most important things. And to deal with the question of poverty, of racism, and class oppression, you have to organize. And I think that's very important. The young lady and a lot of other people said some things very important, but I think particularly coming to Black History Month and Martin Luther King Day a celebration would happen, that's very important. Well, social justice and popular initiative.
Robert, we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you for calling in. And I know this voice as well. These voices I know today. This is Dr. Robert Burt. I used to teach at Morgan, now teaches at Bowie, if I have that right, and is a philosophy professor and an interesting thinker who may be joining us on Monday to talk about Martin Luther King when we have our special on King that day. Maybe some of y'all should come back to talk about organizing in the wake of King as part of that program. We'll work all that out, but we're going to do this again. I want to thank all of you for being here. This has been a really important discussion. Some things came out of this that I hope can churn something going on out here and organize it, and we should all be part of that. I want to thank always good to have you in the studio, Doug Ward, who's director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins. Great to have you with us once again, Doug.
My pleasure.
And Ulysses Cofield, good to meet you. Thanks. 2014 OSI Fellow, founder of CORE. Great to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
And it's always great to see Donya Johnson, leader of the Intersection, one of our most important programs in the city. And I say that as a disclaimer. I am on their board, which is not why I say that. I'm on their board because of what they are, not because I want them on the show. And Michael Johnson, executive director of the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change here in Baltimore, and community activist. Good to have you as well in the studio.
Always good to be here, Mark.
I'll remind you on our way out that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or go to MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, banner at steinershow.org. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be joined by Leah Gilmore, CEM's cultural editor, to look at all manner of issues, starting with a trip to Cuba made by the opera program here at Morgan State University. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Of my mind, people stop and stare.